All right, we start out this morning with the evolution of cellular bonding. Ken Zamko is head of U.S. marketing for LiveU, where he helped turn the company's patented cellular bonding technology into a standard part of daily news gathering. He has been closely involved with the productions of various Super Bowls, Grammy Awards, All-Star Weekends, U.S. elections coverage, Olympics, and World Cups. Ken holds an MBA from the University of Virginia's Darden Business School, and he lives in New York City. Please welcome Ken Zamko.
Thanks, Henry.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. All right. Hello, everyone. Looks like you can hear me. I can hear myself. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. This is my first time at this show. And so thanks, Leonard and Linda, for the kind invitation. Today, what I wanted to talk about was how cellular bonding backpacks and other devices became part of news gathering as we know it today. It sometimes seems like they showed up overnight, so all of a sudden you see all these backpacks out there covering news, but there's actually been several stages in the development of the technology. And I think if you want to know where the technology is going and what to expect in the future and the opportunities that it presents, then it's important to also know how we started and all the different stages that the technology went through. And so I'd like to talk about maybe divide it into three different parts. The first part will be more of an intro, kind of give a few examples of where we were in different points in time. So 2008, when the technology just started out, 2010, 2012, kind of different milestones. Then dive a little bit deeper into the actual technology. So what was available in each generation of the technology and how it improved and kind of the results that our customers producing news were seeing. And also, based on that, where we see the technology going in the next couple of years. And then finally, I wanted to talk a little bit about the topography of cell phone towers and how they operate and all kinds of tricks that we discovered to improve the results when you're using cellular bonding technology. So before I go into my slides, maybe I'll just give those brief, I don't have to call them case studies or examples, but the two main stories that I like to mention are the presidential elections, comparing the 2008 campaign to the 2012 campaign, and then also the World Cup, comparing 2010 to 2014. And so in 2008, our technology was just starting out. It was basically prototypes deployed with a handful of broadcasters around the country and a few around the world. And it still wasn't really mass deployed. And as I'm sure all you guys know, the main way to transmit live video was through satellite trucks, microwave trucks, and so on. And one of the large broadcasters that we work with shared some interesting statistics with us. And so I hope I remember the numbers correctly, but in 2008, they said that they had booked about 1,500 live trucks, so 1,500 truck bookings to cover the presidential campaign that year. And they, at the time, they only had a couple of LiveU backpacks that they mostly used for testing and for uses where you couldn't really fit a live truck. It was more of a novelty than anything else. And fast forward 4 years to 2012, that same network, and I can't mention which network it is, they showed us statistics that they had reduced their truck bookings by 60%. And at the same time, we saw how they increased their number of cellular backpacks. So they went from just a couple of prototypes in 2008 to about 70 or so of our official product at the time, which was the LU60. And so they showed us how they reduced their costs in 60% with satellite. They had increased their number of backpacks. And at the same time, they also created substantially more content. So in 2012, they had embedded reporters on the buses with the candidates. They had a lot more live to web shows and so on. And so with fewer satellite bookings, they were now able to produce a lot more live content for a lot less money. So that's one milestone that I like to mention. The other one is the World Cup. It's sometimes maybe a little bit less relevant to U.S. audiences, though I think in this World Cup, this is the first time where soccer kind of sort of became a legitimate thing to follow, and we've even seen a few local stations, mostly in Florida and California, that went that traveled down to Brazil to cover the World Cup. And so in 2010, that World Cup was in South Africa. We probably had about 30 packs with about 20 customers from around the world. And at the time also, that the technology was mostly regarded as a backup. So they had a backpack just in case the truck broke down or something happened or I don't know what. And there was a very small handful of broadcasters that actually used the technology for the majority of their live shots. And then fast forward to 2014, this year in Brazil. And by the way, I wanted to mention that covering the World Cup is a very challenging thing. So unlike the Olympics or even the Super Bowl for that matter, where you're in one place and you don't have to travel much, especially this year with the World Cup, they had 12 host cities with distances not unlike the U.S. It's like traveling for the World Series. One day you're in Kansas and then you're in San Francisco, for example. And so having to book trucks in that environment is very difficult because every couple of days you need to be in a new city and you cannot drive the truck from one place to the next. And so I think now finally the technology got to the point where broadcasters trusted it enough to not actually reserve a truck when they travel down there and just rely on the backpacks. And so we had about 200 packs there with about 80 broadcasters. So for us, again, that was another big milestone that we were very proud of. And again, it really just showed how much the technology has evolved from being more of a backup or a novelty to something that has a place in the daily news gathering cycle and so on. And so with that, maybe I'll jump to the first slide. Maybe I should push harder. There we go. All right. So, the first step, I touched on it briefly earlier. That was around 2006, 2007, when our co-founders really just started playing around with the idea of using these new data networks that came out to transmit live video. And so back then, the only technologies that were available were what's known as Edge. That was pre-3G, so that was called 2.5G. We had GPRS, also that's pre-3G. And even just connecting to those cars, they didn't even have USB at the time. That was just still the PCMCIA, or we even had in our first prototype, we had an actual phone. So we had a box with a bunch of phones inside, and that was the original LiveView prototype. And it was also not an all-in-one experience. So the encoding was done on a separate laptop, so you would have a number of devices. We were still, I would say, we were more of computer and network people than we were television people. That's the background of many people in our company. A lot of us came from, again, either telecom or hardware manufacturing and so on. We had a little bit less experience specifically with broadcast, so our first prototype didn't have SDI, for example. It had FireWire. And the resolutions were very low. We could only support SIF at that time with the available bandwidth. The bit rates that we saw were no more than 64 kb per modem, so a successful transmission, again, when we started our prototype in 2007, was about 300 kbps. And it was really just a proof of concept. So our first transmission lasted for maybe 20 seconds, and everybody was very excited when it actually worked. And so then, but we did prove the concept. We were able to persuade enough people to invest money in the company and to join the company as engineers and so on. And so then we were able to build a first real product. So that was the LU30. We launched it. We developed it in 2008, launched it in early 2009, and that was just when 3G networks started becoming available. So now instead of having one device for cell phone cards and one device for encoding, we had an all-in-one backpack, so you could just start carrying it around. Instead of using the PCMCIA cards, now There were USB devices that were available that were a little bit easier to work with. The computing platforms that we use now were also getting better, so we had dual core processors, though we still had FireWire in that generation of product. The average bit rates that we saw were typically up to 1.5 megabits per second, which gave us a resolution of about half D1. We were starting to push the latency down to 2 seconds, though it was with very limited resiliency. So whenever you had some issues with the networks, then the shot could very easily drop. It was all Windows-based because this is how we first started out. It was the fastest way for us to go to market with this type of product. And in general, it was, you know, what you would expect of a first-generation product. It still had had a lot of room for growth, but thankfully, we started seeing networks, local stations in some markets testing the technology. And the uses, as I mentioned earlier, were mostly either for things that you couldn't do before. So a lot of folks like to start putting them in cars and drive around in either snow or rain or things like that, which previously was not possible, or to go cover live press conferences on the 10th floor of a building where previously you weren't able to. But in general, most live shots were still coming from satellite and microwave. That was we were still the novelty, we were still the backup. So that was 2009. When we then moved towards 2010 and 2011 is when the 4G networks started becoming available. They still weren't everywhere. It was limited coverage, so mostly the big markets, mostly in the more highly trafficked parts of those big markets. WiMAX was coming out, even though now it's it looks like it's going to be discontinued. And we've started learning some things about the behavior of cell networks and how to optimize the performance. So the first thing we realized was that those what started as those PCMC IA cards and then became USB air cards or MiFi devices are really intended for consumer purposes. They don't have the antennas inside, and they're not configured in a way that would optimize both the communication with the tower in terms of range, in terms of sort of noise reduction and so on, and also in terms of the speed of communication between the modem and the hardware. So they would add a little bit of latency in the communication. So what we did in that phase of the product was we introduced special RF modules to replace those USB air cards, and that increased our range to the towers. It also now provided a way to overcome a lot of the noise and what's known as multipath fading. So, and I'll show a little bit of that in one of the upcoming slides. But generally what happens when you have signal coming from a tower to your device, and I'm sure a lot of you guys might be familiar with that, the signal will bounce around through multiple obstacles. So whether it's walls, beams, trees, whatever it is that's out there in the way, the signal is going to bounce around through. And your cell phone typically, or your USB air card, might not always find the cleanest path because of the direction that it's pointing. So if my cell phone is pointed that way, it might see the signal bouncing through that beam, which might be very weak, but there might be another one coming from this direction, which is much cleaner and much better. But again, the direction of the antenna and the device itself will determine how it operates. So we created those RF modules that were multi-directional, and with the ability to actually identify which signal path is better and which one to use. So that improved our results. Also, as mentioned, the range became longer, and we were also now able, because it was an integral part of our hardware, we were now able to communicate faster. So the data that showed up on the modem and on the antenna was going into our encoding hardware much faster, so that reduced the delay just a little bit further. The computing platforms also kept improving, so we had stronger processors to work with, which also improved the results. And by that point, we already had several years of experience in the industry. We Had also hired a lot of people who were very familiar with broadcast workflows, and we had a lot of really good feedback from customers. So the units became much more ruggedized. They now supported standards like SDI and so on. And for the first time, thanks to those initial LTE deployments, we were able to see HD coming out of the backpacks. It wasn't always the best quality HD. I mean, it was HD format, but it wasn't always the best quality. Again, if we didn't have great signal, we might have seen a drop and so on, but it was starting to improve. The latency also continued shrinking from 2 seconds to closer to 1 second. And we've introduced features like IFB and other features that our customers ask us for. And what we also started seeing at that point is that there was now broader penetration in the market. So more stations, more networks, more sports organizations started trusting the technology for their news workflows. It was still an earlier stage, but we did start seeing some groups adopt on a wider scale. So if in the earlier years, it would have been a station here and a station there, now all of a sudden we had some large groups that have adopted cellular bonding technologies across their groups, and that was also a big milestone for us. And we started seeing more of that initial sort of novelty thing that I mentioned earlier of weather coverage on the move that until then you couldn't really do. So then in the next stage, which over here I have it as 2011 to 2013, but in many ways it's we're still in that stage. There are a lot of things that are happening right now that kind of reflect what's in this slide. So now what we're seeing is much broader LTE deployment in many more markets. It's still not perfect. You still have a lot of smaller markets that might not have the latest LTE networks and towers, or if you get away from the most highly trafficked areas, then maybe you won't get that 4G LTE coverage, or maybe not even good 3G coverage. But the coverage is starting to expand dramatically. And we've seen it mostly, the easiest way for us to notice is going to the same venue year over year. So if we looked at our customers going to football stadiums, baseball stadiums, and so on, and in one season, we would kind of notice what the bandwidth was and if there were any drops and so on, and then they would come back there the next year with our newer version of hardware, and when a certain carrier may have deployed a new tower or increased the capacity and so on, and all of a sudden the results were now better, and this is a trend that we're continuing to see. So I think in some of the bigger markets, now that we have XLTE and so on, we're seeing very consistent throughput. Our units sometimes push about 8 megabits per second in a very consistent way, though in smaller markets there's still a lot of room for improvement. But I think one of the reasons that we're optimistic is that we are seeing those maps, those color maps of the carriers expanding and expanding, and it becomes more cost effective for them also to deploy those new towers. So this is something that we believe we'll see improving even further. Then on the hardware side, now all of a sudden, this has become an industry. Other companies were already becoming active in this market, and you have all kinds of variety of different devices. We introduced a mini unit that could go on cameras. There were all types of new offerings out there. Now, of course, there were performance trade-offs. So if we had our big backpack that at the time weighed about 20 pounds and we had our mini device, the bigger backpack performed much better. It was more resilient, provided better picture quality and so on, but it was pretty heavy. On the other hand, you had the mini units that were much smaller and easier to carry, but they also didn't perform as well. We and other companies started offering all types of vehicle integrations, and that's actually something that we're seeing taking off much more these days, with the ability to combine cellular with Ka band and even with IP-based microwave. And so if until recently cellular was still considered the sort of not guaranteed transmission because of coverage. And Ka band also doesn't have 100% coverage yet, and it's not really suitable for all weather conditions. The combination of both of them now gives you that added stability and resiliency so that you can still transmit in almost every location around the US. You can transmit in almost every type of weather, yet at a fraction of the cost of your traditional satellite. So, and also at a much smaller footprint. So if you needed to have a much bigger vehicle until recently, now we're seeing a lot of stations across the country going to some of our partners like AMT and building new SUVs that have a Ka dish and a cellular antenna on the roof. And again, it's a more cost-effective way to get live coverage, yet it's still almost, or if not as reliable, as having your traditional sat truck. And then on the software side, we start seeing more applications, not just for hardware that we make, but for other types of hardware. So using cell phones, bonding multiple connections, like the cell phone's LTE connection with Wi-Fi or a MiFi device to go to the same LiveView receiver that that the backpacks transmit to. And so we've started seeing some stations around the country also deploying that, so giving it either to reporters or other station employees that happen to be near a breaking news location and can just point their phone and contribute that video in the same way as a LiveView unit would offer it into the to ingest into the studio, except without doing it at a lower quality Skype or FaceTime, and again with an easier workflow. And we also started seeing groups now sharing feeds. So you could have a backpack in one city sending feeds to their sister stations in other markets when a big story broke. And basically, there was this whole new ecosystem of options became available. So it wasn't just the satellite truck, which was your guaranteed live shot, and your backpack, which was your backup or your novelty use. You had this breadth of solutions. So you had an option to deploy a vehicle, an option to deploy a backpack or a small device or a smartphone, and just a lot more options. And so where do we see things going next? So in 2014, 2015, and beyond, I mentioned earlier, we're now seeing LTE and XLTE much more widely deployed, and we will see even more of that. And there's LTE Advanced that the industry is talking about. And for years now, there have been conversations about guaranteed bandwidth, at least for broadcasters, so providing quality of service. So right now that's still not the case, though we are starting to see other countries around the world beginning to offer sort of the QS offering. It's still not what we're fully hoping for, but to give one example, during the London Olympics a couple of years ago, one of the local carriers there offered something that is similar to the VIP pass at a theme park, so that if you had that type of SIM card inside your device, you would get prioritized over everyone else. And so it's still not that guaranteed bandwidth, because if you had 1,000 VIPs connecting to the tower, there would still be congestion. But if you had just a handful of VIPs and a bunch of, call it non-VIP SIM cards, then you could get much better performance. And we saw that in action in London for the Olympics. The carriers in the US have been a little bit more hesitant to launch these types of offerings. But based on some conversations that we had with them, we believe that in the next couple of years, there might be some pilots that will start testing the idea. You know, I don't want to say that this is something that that will exist in 2 or 3 years, but it's something that the carriers are definitely considering to offer. And we know that once this happens, if indeed it happens, then the reliability of cellular transmission will be exactly the same as any other form of satellite transmission and so on. In terms of the hardware, we're starting to see it now in some of the latest generations of devices out there. The trade-off between size and performance is not really there anymore. So if the option was to carry a 20-pound backpack with batteries in order to be able to get that live shot, or carry a small device that may or may not be able to carry that shot, now we have much smaller devices that perform in the same way. And this is, you know, what people refer to as Moore's Law, that every couple of years or every 18 months you'll have a doubling of the computing power for half the size. So this is exactly what we're seeing here. So the hardware keeps getting smaller and smaller, yet the computing and processing and encoding and bandwidth capabilities keep improving constantly. What we're doing now is also we're using multiprocessor encoding. So where we used to have one computer handle all of the workload, we now have different chips in the hardware handling different tasks. So one chip will handle the transmission or the cellular data, one will handle the encoding, and so on, and that gives us a better ability to process the video. We're seeing longer battery life. There's the H.265 readiness that we're starting to work on. So kind of all these, I would call it normal phases of a maturing technology that's kind of reaching its prime, where, again, it's no longer 2008 or 9, where it was an early stage technology. Now it's an existing platform that keeps getting optimized and further enhanced. And what I mentioned earlier with the hybrid options, so Ka band, new BGAN HDR options that you can bond together, and the IP-based microwave. What else are we seeing right now that I think we'll continue seeing in the next couple of years? So there's a gradual movement to the cloud. I know a lot of people mention the cloud all the time, but what does that mean specifically for services like ours? So the first one is being able to control and monitor and manage your fleet from the cloud without relying just on the receiver in the station. So we've sort of decoupled that relationship where everything, all the control happens on the cloud, all the feeds go through the cloud, which make it easier for us in the future to route them, to simulcast them to multiple destinations at the same time. Also, it gives the ability to get ready to offer more cloud storage as well. So the footage that's coming from the backpacks can be archived automatically on the cloud and then can be downloaded whenever needed later on. So you don't necessarily have to record everything that's coming out of the backpack or store everything. Obviously, it depends on the workflow that you're using, but it's just more options that we'll have out there, more options for including metadata and so on. We are also starting to see a gradual move to IP, and I'm guessing that's a topic that might have come up in other sessions here at the show. I don't think SDI is going to disappear anytime in the next couple of years. I think most workflows will still rely on that. But we are starting to see, especially with some of the new generation cameras that now have either Wi-Fi or they have a single cellular connection on them and they're able to send video. So we're going to see more collaborations between different companies of getting video in an IP format from one device to the next and to the next. And again, I don't think SDI will disappear very quickly, but I think we're probably 2 to 3 years away from seeing very nicely integrated IP-based workflows to get the video from one place to another. So the bit rates that we're seeing right now, I mentioned we went from 300 kbps in 2007 to about 8 mbps as of last year, and now in some places we're even seeing an average of 10 megabits per second, and even more. If we wanted to, we could probably transmit now at 15 or even 20 megabits per second. The reason that we don't think it's wise to start transmitting at those rates is that there's still fluctuation. And whenever there's fluctuation and there might be a drop, then you'll see a much more visible change in quality. So if you're going from 10 megabits per second to 8 megabits per second, the viewer is not gonna notice too much of a difference, whereas if you drop from 15 to 8, they'll notice a lot of pixelization on the screen. But we will see that continuing to grow as LTE networks become more stable and more widely deployed, then we'll see a lot more of that. Again, the low latency option now is something that is much more reliable than it used to be several years back. We're able to push full 1080 resolution. And I mentioned earlier the ability to remote control from the cloud, which is making it much easier to operate a fleet of devices. So it's not just a one-to-one relationship, but you can have someone who's trained to manage an entire fleet of devices from one location to control, for example, the devices of stations all over the country. And then part of that maturing of the industry also means that we're able to find new uses for it. If the focus of our technology was just to send video up, that was what we did. We took video from the camera and we sent it up to through the towers and then to the station. Now we're able to open up that technology because we kind of have those few years of experience with it, because we have a little bit more resources to put into it, we can turn the devices into hotspots. And so it's no longer an appliance that is designed, to send one-way video, but now you can just open it up to upload any type or download any type of file, to use internet in the field. So you basically have a jumbo hotspot that that the crew in the field can use when they're not transmitting live video. And then kind of finally about this this stage, I think if we started out with just a handful of beta testers, we believe that now about 90%, if not more, of groups across the US are using or at least testing cellular bonding technologies. From our estimate, and it kind of varies by market, our estimate is right now that in many markets, 40 to 60% of live shots are coming from backpacks. And but again, it really depends on the market and the station. There are some markets where it might only be 10 or 20% because 4G is still not available there, or because it's a remote area that even 3G is not that great in. But generally, these are the ranges that we believe are taking place right now. And we think that with those further advances in LTE, XLTE, the potential launch of LTE Advanced, the potential introduction of a quality of service package from some of the cellular carriers, we think we'll see a lot more of that happening. So a lot more live shots coming from backpacks as opposed to the traditional truck, or not necessarily backpacks, it could be backpacks and the new type of hybrid cellular plus Ka band vehicle, and not necessarily from your traditional truck. And so with that, I wanted to talk a little bit about how cell phone networks operate and some of the tricks that we've used to battle that that congestion and the structure of the network. So let's say we're in a crowded environment. It could be just a large gathering or a busy street and so on. And I hope I can show. So let's say we have a pack. Oh, is this not going to show up for me here? There we go. So let's say our tower and our backpack are located in that cell, which here is called S3A. So the way that towers work, or the permission in with networks works is that it's sort of a beehive where if you are here, you can only communicate, or if your tower is here, the only devices that can communicate with this tower are the ones immediately surrounding it. So all the people in those areas are the ones that will get their bandwidth from this tower. And if there happens to be congestion in this tower, then that's what causes the problem. So even if this tower over here is wide open, but you're standing right here in this corner, you're still going to communicate with this tower because this is the permission you're getting, and you're not going to communicate with this tower, which is wide open. And then the other thing that could happen is, you know, even though you are within range of the tower, if you are located over here, it might be a very weak signal at this point, which will not give you the same type of bandwidth that you would get if you were, you know, closer to the tower. And so this is something that a lot of people who use cellular are familiar with, and that's kind of the nature of the towers. So what have we done to start combating this? I mentioned earlier the special antenna modules and multi-directional antennas that we developed. So what does that mean? It means that if your cell phone can only reach, you know, this far, then your special antenna in the backpack can reach farther, and then we've created those special external antennas that we can put on vehicles that can reach even farther. So what does that mean? That's not going to solve the problem of being located here and still not being able to communicate with this tower. You're still communicating with this tower, except if you're at the very edge of the coverage, your stronger antenna will give you that cleaner signal. It's been bouncing around a little bit less than it would have otherwise. And again, you're avoiding a lot of the noise that previously you were not able to overcome. But the bottom line is, if there's tens of thousands of people trying to get the bandwidth from this tower, it's still going to cause an issue. Gradually less of an issue, again, because of the introduction of much more powerful networks, and as mentioned, especially in the big markets, we've seen dramatic improvements. So even in very congested areas, we still see better performance now, but this is still not everywhere around the country. And so then let's move on to the next scenario. All right, so we thought, what can we do to break away from that congested tower? We know the story is taking place here. So the camera has to be here. We can't move the camera. But can we do something else to start talking to a different tower? So with wireless RF, we can now have the external antenna that can sit in that vehicle, or that could also be Ka band. So that special new hybrid vehicle that I mentioned earlier can now be parked, let's say, on top of the hill, somewhere within reasonable distance to where the action is taking place. And then you can just, you know, park it somewhere near this where you have reasonable line of sight to this tower. And then with a short range RF, things like Ubiquiti device and so on, you can basically avoid that congestion. So everybody, again, I'm using the example of a stadium, though it could be any kind of a large gathering, it could be a rally, it could be whatever it is. So while everybody here is using their phones and they have congestion and they can't really break away from that, again, your vehicle now sits here and talks wirelessly to the pack that's over here. Now, this requires an understanding by the operator on how to accomplish this successfully. So you got to figure out, all right, where do I put that external antenna, or where do I park that vehicle, and how do I set up my wireless receiver to be able to get that live shot. And granted, sometimes you don't have the time to invest in that. Though my personal thought is, you know, it takes so much training and knowledge to operate a traditional satellite truck that I think that figuring out how to deploy those short-range receivers to be able to leverage cellular, I think it's something that's definitely doable and can dramatically improve results in those situations where you have a lot of congestion. And I believe this is my last slide, and I see we have 6 minutes on the clock here. So with that, maybe I'll open it up for questions.
I was wondering, you were talking about those VIP passes that are popular in Europe but not yet catching on here in the country. Do you think that that feature of the cell phone carriers will be affected by whatever happens to net neutrality in this country?
I can't say I'm an expert on net neutrality, but I think these are, to me these are separate issues, because cell phone networks are generally regarded as a end-user technology, so it's a consumer technology, whereas net neutrality mostly impacts organizations like Netflix and Google and so on, who want to send large amounts of data. So in my mind, these are two separate topics, but I guess it's possible that people might lump them in together. But from my perspective, I think it's separate.
Right. You mentioned the booster, mm-hmm. Whether mounted on a tripod or on a vehicle, and placement being important. We're trying one out right now, and isn't one of the other key things about it that you're making 12 connections instead of 6? Mm-hmm.
So what's the question?
So the question is, doesn't the just the use of 12 connections help? And can you speak more to the placement of the key placement of the booster?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So adding connections can help and does help, though in good coverage areas we've seen that sometimes even 3 or 4 connections can provide just as much bandwidth as 10 or 12. So for a long time our magic number has been, we considered it as 6, that was really the magic number that we went with for a number of years. But in extreme situations, yes, the 12 connections, so having those additional 6 connections in the extender or the booster, they can definitely help, especially in 3G environments. So if you have a good 4G environment where each modem is giving you 2 or 3 or 4 megabits per second, then it doesn't really matter if you have that additional capacity. But if you only have 3G and each modem is giving you, let's say, 300K or 500K, then yes, absolutely, then those additional modems can provide a substantial boost. And being able to put those connections in a farther away spot also can help to place it closer to the tower. So does that answer the question?
Can you speak to placement?
Oh, to placement, in terms of where to put the booster or the truck? Yeah, so if you because this is what I do, I kind of have gotten into the habit of always looking up and seeing where the towers are. And now whenever I drive down a highway, I automatically notice them. And you have places where it just looks like a tower. And you have places where they try to make them look a little bit nicer and prettier by having all these plastic branches coming out and painting them green and so on. But if you can identify a tower and put the pack or the antenna close to that tower that you've identified, usually that can help. So the closer to the tower, the better. And then in terms of the communication between the vehicle or the extender or the booster and the backpack, generally for that short range RF, you should have reasonable line of sight. That's not to say that if there's a tree in the middle, it would completely block it, or if there's a car window or something, but generally it's good to have a fairly decent line of sight between the two devices.
So I think you partially answer. Does there kind of mapping that shows where these towers are placed in areas, And also whose tower it is, because I presume it matters that we get the right carrier. In this case, I think is it Verizon?
Mm-hmm.
So that, of course, would be important. Is there any kind of mapping that you're aware of that shows any of this?
Yeah. So right now, the carriers themselves publish maps. So you can go on their websites and see where they have coverage. Though that's not really a guarantee, because you could have coverage in a downtown area with a lot of buildings, but your press conference is on the 20th floor, and even though on the map that shows as a red dot where, you know, the carrier has signal, that doesn't mean that that specific room will have that good signal. So it's something that you can use as reference, but it's not a guarantee. What we might do at some point, and it will, it'll take us some time, is we may be able to kind of tell you on a map where we've seen good results previously, but that's not a guarantee either, because one day could be, you know, different than the next. Maybe one day there's less congestion, more congestion, so it's still very difficult to predict.
We have one final question here.
You talk about the wireless link between the PAC and your extended antenna. Is two-part question. Is that a solution that you provide? And if you do, what type of a link is it? What frequency band is it?
Yep. So this is not a solution that we manufacture. We partner with other companies, and there are a few of them out there. So if you look at IP-based microwave, you have all kinds of different things. So you can have a point-to-point device called Ubiquiti. You can have an IP-based mesh network called Silvus. And so there's a variety of options out there. Usually in the US, they operate on unlicensed 5 gigahertz and 2.4. That's usually how they operate. Do we have time for? All right. Thanks, everyone. I'll be around for the rest of the day if you want to say hello. And my colleague, Kurt Carruthers, is also here in the back. He manages our Midwest region, so feel free to say hi to both of us. Right. Thank you.